28 years ago, the Unitarian Universalist Association came up with a set of principles and purposes to say who we are, subsequently endorsed and adopted by the Canadian Unitarian Council. They include the statement, "The living tradition we share draws from many sources," and goes on to itemize such sources. Here at Beacon, your worship committee has suggested that guest speakers this year address themselves to one or other of those sources. So what I'm going to say today relates to the first one in that list. But first of all, let's look briefly at that word, sources. Its use here is, of course, a metaphor. Literally, it means, as I think it still always does mean in French, a spring or fountainhead giving rise to a river. And the river has always been a metaphor for the stream in human history that we call a tradition. The water from the original spring flows continually down the river, augmented all the time by water from other springs or sources, so that as we follow its course, we are looking not only back at the past, but around us at the present and forward into the future. We here in BC are well placed to appreciate the power of that metaphor of the river. As my old friend Richard Bocking, a member of the congregation in Victoria, says in his splendid book about the Fraser, and I quote, "During a tumultuous 1,370-kilometer descent to the sea, thousands of rivulets merge into one great river. 10,000 years of Aboriginal history are written in its flow. There may be no place in the world where so much diversity and beauty is woven into a single tapestry by the flow of a river." All this is what I understand us to be talking about when we speak of sources. And the first one from which our living tradition is said to draw is described in these words: "Direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder, affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life." In brief, what that means is personal growth, spiritual growth, as our life experience unfolds. And I can certainly testify that this has been a personal quest of mine for as long as I can remember. In fact, it was such a quest that took me, while still a teenager, out of the church of my upbringing to become a Unitarian. Not in the first instance because of intellectual difficulties with traditional dogmas, nor through a search for an authentic religious community, although both of these soon followed, but because I did not feel nourished in my spiritual growth at a deeper level. Everything seemed like dry rote repetition. Among Unitarians, I did find a supportive community that respected my pursuing my own spiritual quest. But it was not until years later that I found great help through becoming acquainted with the work of someone who showed me how community and spirituality can combine to lead that quest forward. Martin Buber. Listen to his words.
All history is a genuine community of human beings. Genuine because it is community all through. Guarded against all contamination by sentimentality or emotionalism. A community of faith truly exists only when it is a community of work. The real essence of community is to be found in the fact, manifest or otherwise, that it has a center. The real beginning of a community is when its members have a common relation to the center, overriding all other relations. The center is described by the radii, not by the points along its circumference. And the originality of the center cannot be discerned unless it is discerned as being transpicuous to the light of something divine.
And I find that imagery really powerful. We can join hands around a circle and feel we have community. But, says Buber, what is really important is what is in the center of the circle, the light of something divine. Is the discovery of that light what we mean when we speak of spiritual growth? In recent years, there's been a lot of talk about spirituality. And a lot of questions asked as to what we mean when we use that word. My own response to such questions is that the closest synonym for spirituality is connectedness. By which I mean Buber's image of the circle. We are connected to one another as we link hands around the circumference. But more important, we are connected by the radii to the light at the center. But light is insubstantial. A totally empty room may be full of light. Is there another way of describing what is really at the center? And here let me turn to the wisdom of the great Chinese classic, the Tao Te Ching, the wisdom of which I've been reabsorbing lately. Here's the way it sees the picture.
30 spokes converge in the hub of a wheel. But the usefulness of the wheel will depend on the part of the hub that is void. Clay is molded into a bowl, but the usefulness of the bowl will depend on the part of the bowl that is void.
Void. Empty. Think about it. As I do, my thoughts go back to a historical incident that has fascinated me ever since I first ran across it. It dates from a little over 2,000 years ago, a time when the expanding Roman Empire was taking its place in the long succession of powers that have dominated the Middle East. The little Jewish state, which had only recently become precariously independent, put up a surprisingly stiff resistance to Pompey, the Roman general, as he moved south. But his powerful army eventually crushed this opposition. The city walls of Jerusalem were breached, and the Romans poured in. There remained only the inner citadel, the fortified temple hill on the top of which stood the temple itself, the center of the people's life and religion. After a desperate struggle, this too was taken by storm, and Pompey stood at the doors of the temple. Inside, he knew, was the secret of the stubborn resistance these people had put up against such overwhelming odds. Like the other nations he had conquered, they had put their hope and trust in their particular God as their defender. What, he wondered, would this God be like? A massive human form? Or one of the fantastic animal forms as in the temples of Egypt? He gave the signal. His men broke down the doors and he strode in. They moved through the outer courts and into the inner court, the place of sacrifices to be entered only by the priests. Beyond it lay the Holy of Holies, screened by heavy curtains, and to be entered only by the high priest on the most solemn of occasions. The Romans went over to the great curtains, swept them aside, and Pompey walked boldly in. A gasp went up from everyone as they saw what was inside. No image, not even the picture. Nothing. The Holy of Holies was totally empty. And there was no evidence that it had ever been otherwise. This great temple that had been defended so tenaciously had only empty space in the middle. Void. Let's move now from the ancient world to the modern world for one more illustration of what I'm trying to talk about. The United Nations building in New York has what is called a meditation room. And years ago, a leading Unitarian Universalist minister, Walter Royal Jones, who chaired the committee that produced the principles and purposes that included the sources with which we began, visited that room and memorably described it. Here's what he said.
The walls converge as they extend away from the viewer, creating a curious psychological effect. For the eye receives conflicting signals as to the actual depth of the sanctuary, the focusing of the eye giving one hint, and the exaggerated perspective of the lines where the wall and floor meet giving another. A similar ambiguity is created by the ceiling, which hangs free of the walls, with the light spilling over the edges from above. One does not know how high the walls really are. There is a strange sense that the room is invaded by a space larger than its obvious walls. One must not come into this space with preconceptions. It is better to let the room, with its enigmatic patterns, pull out from within the meanings and fragments of meaning which feeling and memory supply. That in our meditation, we may discover many meanings within ourselves and reorder them into a new and larger harmony.
And he went on to describe what is in the center of that room. Not, to be sure, a complete emptiness, but as apt a symbol of that as can be imagined. A simple block of stone. And what the room was intended to convey was indicated by the then Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, when the room was dedicated. His words.
We all have within us a center of stillness surrounded by silence. This house, dedicated to work and debate in the service of peace, should have one room dedicated to silence in the outward sense and stillness in the inward sense. There is an ancient saying that the sense of a vessel is not in its shell, but in the void. So it is with this room. It is for those who come here to fill the void with what they find in their center of stillness.
Stillness surrounded by silence. That word silence opens up another field for meditation. It's not just that we are nonplussed like Pompey by not seeing anything in the void. Silence means that not only do we see nothing, we don't hear anything either. The center of stillness lies further within than anything accessible either by sight or by hearing. In what the great 20th century theologian Paul Tillich called the holy void. Now, how do we Unitarians relate to all this? You might at first think that we really haven't taken silence seriously, even though most services nowadays have a token minute or two of it. But we would find it hard to relate to what an earlier Unitarian, Ralph Waldo Emerson, wrote. I like the silent church before the service begins better than any preaching. Most of our churches are anything but silent before the service begins. However, there is another kind of void in relation to silence that we do experience more often, and is sometimes commented on by newcomers and visitors. If they have come from a background in which going to church entailed hearing the word God countless times in every service, they may notice how reticent, if not completely silent, we are in using it. I remember that one person who came to the Vancouver church for a while during my ministry there wrote a long account of his experiences, to which he gave the title, A Church Without God. Pompey, I suppose, might have said the same about the temple in Jerusalem. And I'm not being facetious in that reference to Pompey and the temple. The ancient Hebrews, for whom this was their holy of holies, had a much more stringent taboo on the use of the word God than we do, as expressed in number 3 of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. In other words, be extremely careful where and how you use it. Those who took their religion most seriously guarded themselves against inadvertently breaking that commandment by avoiding the use of the word altogether, using circumlocutions. And that has continued among the most Orthodox Jews right down to the present day. Even that expression, the Lord, is suspect, drawn as it is from human structures of aristocracy. When I'm quoting from the Bible, I usually translate it as the ineffable, which I think is truer to the spirit of the original writers. A verbal idol can be just as dangerous as a visual one. It narrows and constricts your range of thinking and feeling, your depth of worship. The ineffable. Here, let me give you a very short poem by D.H. Lawrence, a poet and mystic rather than a theologian. But I have to say that in my own spiritual evolution, I've often gained a great deal more from the poets than from the theologians. At any rate, this is what Lawrence wrote.
forever nameless, forever unknown, forever unconceived, forever unrepresented, yet forever felt in the soul.
Yes. Not seen, not heard, but felt. And this, I think, is where the heart of religion is. Not in names or pictures or images, but in the feeling of the soul. People may argue forever about words and about dogmas or theories that are couched in words. They may argue about the appropriateness or otherwise of pictures and images and symbols. But what it comes right down to in the end is the feeling in the soul. And the way we give expression to that feeling in our practical conduct and in the shared life of the world. For what do we really find if we enter into the holy void? Go back to the examples I quoted earlier. The Tao Te Ching looked at the spokes of a wheel converging upon the empty space at the hub. And that space makes it possible for the wheel to embrace an axle, a word that is historically the same as the word axis, as in the axis mundi, that around which the whole world revolves. The Chinese classic also spoke of how the usefulness of a bowl consists in the emptiness it contains, an emptiness of potential. As when Buber spoke of the empty space, the empty center, being transpicuous to the light of the divine. A light, again, which shines upon the rock in the UN meditation room. I described how moving I found the illustration of community as gathered around in a circle, linking hands, if you will, but united primarily, not by their relationship to one another, but by their shared relationship to the center, united by the radii, not by the circumference. This summer, I've been reading a remarkable book called Circling the Sacred Mountain. The authors describe their pilgrimage to Mount Kailash in Tibet, a place known to and revered by millions of Buddhists and Hindus, but so difficult of access that it is visited only by a few hundred each year. It is so sacred that no one has ever dared to try to climb it. But since it stands in isolation from any continuous range, it is possible to follow a circular route around the base, which takes several days. The Tibetans picture a wonderful unseen temple on its summit, the home of the great god Shiva. So much for the world of creative imagination. In actual fact, of course, it wouldn't be necessary to climb that mountain in order to see what's really on the summit. It could be inspected from the air, or even from a distant vantage point through a powerful telescope. So far as I can gather from photographs, what a climber who defied the prohibitions and went up there would in fact see is what I saw years ago when I climbed to the summit of Mount Baker. Just a great expanse of snow without form or feature, and on the horizon, a view over vast distances. Once again, as close an approximation as one can get to empty space. And in his book on Sacred Mountains of the World, Edwin Birnbaum writes,
The Tibetan Buddhists view Kailas with the invisible pagoda palace of the deity on its summit as the center of a mandala or sacred circle that represents the divine space, where they will come to know the power and wisdom to awaken their own true nature and transform their experience of the world from a profane place of illusion into the sacred realm of ultimate reality. The pattern of such a mandala appears frequently in works of Tibetan art, depicting the universe as a circle of mountains, oceans, and continents, arrayed around a mythical mountain at the very center, shooting up from the depths of hell to the heights of heaven and the great void that lies beyond.
Well, where has this gathering around the holy void taken us? Before I close, I want to return to that story of Pompey in the temple. As I said, that story has fascinated me for a long time. And a major part of its fascination has been that it can be looked at in a different way, as a kind of parable, if you will. It would be a travesty, of course, to suggest that Pompey was making a religious pilgrimage. But nonetheless, it's uncanny to see how his breakthrough into the innermost sanctum parallels the personal pilgrimage we make in our own inner life as we seek spiritual growth. As Dag Hammarskjöld said, we all have within us a center of stillness. And those who have given us a roadmap for silent meditation tell us that to reach that center, we have to empty the mind, engrossed as it usually is with everyday trivia or even with important plans and projects. That prescription is also in the Tao Te Ching. And we who have taken the liberal path in religion have often made the mistake of supposing that intellectual processes, left brain activities, can lead us to enlightenment. I plead guilty. We become very skilled in molding the clay to make the bowl a beautiful bowl, rather than attending to what the bowl will contain. The emptiness, the center of stillness, the holy void, that would leave us open to a deeper understanding of who we are and what makes this life of ours really meaningful. And again, like Pompey, we don't find the approaches easy and wide open, but the outcome justifies the effort. Out of the depths, out of the emptiness that has not been filled with some prefabricated image, out of the silence, something emerges, if we are open, as Lawrence put it, to feel it in the soul. The story of the prophet Elijah in the Bible called it a still small voice, which again we have to add is felt rather than heard. Where that voice originates is a question that pulls us back into intellectual processes and is therefore not helpful. In that center of stillness, who knows? What can be counted as part of the individual ego and what lies beyond? As Buber put it, it is transpicuous to the light of something divine. And Buber began with a circle. 3 weeks ago, I sat in a silent circle at a Quaker meeting, where together we sought that center of stillness and felt the strength of a supportive community. A few days earlier, I walked a labyrinth, in which the long and involved circular journey led to the empty space in the middle and back again out into the life of the wider world. Well, these are some of the thoughts that have come to my mind as I follow the river that flows out of that source with which we began. You too, I think, would find it profitable to spend some time in making that same kind of journey in your own way.